Segundo 8 here. You see, it has something to do with this. He took the A train to jump for joy at a sophisticated lady. He had it bad. That ain't good. Three little words were all he had before talking with a satin doll, daydreaming, getting lost in meditation, thinking, I've got to be a rug cutter. I wish I could say that he never felt this way before. Weak talk, but something to live for, particularly when you're in a sentimental mood. For those who decry conceptual introductions for authors of conceptual novels, Segundo's beginning to see the light, which is why he's not here. Segundo's still not showing up, dutifully attending some strange class, but the Duke still swings, even if they're calling 106th Street Ellington Boulevard by mistake.
Okay, so I am here with Adam Langer, who is the author most recently of Ellington Boulevard. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Oh, good.
First, I'm a block from my apartment. This is a good day.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Well, I wanted to first of all ask you about this book in relation to topography. As you know, probably, Nabokov had this rule that he could not write a book unless he absolutely knew the lay of the land and the topography. And I'm wondering if this is the sense with all your work, because here you are having a third novel that is related to
exactly where I live and where I've been. And I would hate to say that I couldn't write a book that I wasn't aware of. I'd like to be able to write something, you know, fantastical that takes place someplace I've never been. But I find myself really having to know, at least for this book and the first three books, really having to know everywhere there is. So for this book, I wrote my first two books about Chicago after I had left there, and this one I really wanted to write something in the moment where I was and in this New York moment, so I really had to know every inch of Ellington Boulevard here.
Mm-hmm. Got you. Well, in terms of like the characters and things like that, I'm wondering how this factors in. Do they come from the environment?
They do.
Are they sort of there from the beginning? Or I mean,
no,
do you think
they grow. Their professions change as I get to know them. Their biographies change as I get to know them. But I really, once I have them, once I know who they are, and that is a growing process, I really have to know everything about them, from their biography to what they like to eat for dinner to the kind of music they listen. And I use a kind of writing. I used to be involved in theater, and I didn't do this at all in theater, and it's more popular in theater called method acting, but I do a lot of method writing.
Yeah.
In that, when I'm writing from a character's perspective, I want to listen to the kind of music they're listening to. I want to experience the world the way they experience it, and that's, you know, goes for the human characters and the animal characters as well. So when I'm writing from the perspective of a guy who's into show tunes, I'm listening to Stephen Sondheim. When I'm writing from the perspective of a dog, I'm really concentrating on scents and sounds.
Gotcha. Now, in terms of the dog, there's something about the dialogue there that is quite interesting in the sense that all the words are strung together. There are no spaces.
Right.
Not even a demarcation in terms of who's speaking.
Now, except Bold and Roman.
Well, there is that. But even some, I mean, it just kind of is strung together. And I'm curious about how this came about. And I'm also curious in terms of the relation of the other use of dialogue you often have, in which it's almost reminiscent of theatrical direction in the sense that you have someone saying something,
speech.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly, in a paragraph, in a very big, chunky paragraph versus very literal
quotes. Well, there are two different reasons going on. When I'm writing from a particular perspective and I want to write from a perspective, that particular perspective, I sometimes think putting it into quotations takes it out of that point of view, and it becomes, instead of one person's point of view, it becomes this objective piece of reportage, whereas if I keep it in the indirect speech, I keep the impression of the person who's listening. Whereas with the dog, I mean, he hears certain things but doesn't necessarily understand the words, so I wanted to have all the words so people know what's being said, but at the same time, I wanted it to be a little more difficult to understand because, you know, I'm not writing from a human perspective, I'm writing from a dog perspective.
There's also the pigeon perspective as well, and when you describe the eggs, and I'm wondering, what is it about animal perspectives that are an important part of the neighborhood? Is it just a matter of really wanting to describe natural urban scavengers or very commonplace kind of animals?
You know, there are a lot of, when I go back to look at it, yeah, I had no idea why I was writing from the perspective of pigeons. I just wanted to write about this apartment and try and see everyone who was affected by what was going on in it. So the pigeons are affected for one reason or another. The dog is affected. And then gradually I would get to know their story. But I didn't go in thinking, as I wrote, I said, oh, while this pigeon is, it's fairly comparable to the people having to move, having to get up, leaving this nomadic Manhattan existence. But when I wrote it, I just wanted to write about pigeons. And ditto for the dog. I'm a dog walker. A lot of my relationships in the neighborhood come from dog walking. A lot of the people I know, the stories I've heard, come from people I walk dogs with, not people who I shoot the shit about writing with. It's people we talk about dogs, and then conversations start about the neighborhoods. So, I mean, being a dog owner and walking my dog in this neighborhood is very much, for me, what it's about. So to leave the dog's perspective out of it would be leaving out a big chunk.
But also to have the dog perspective be a... I don't want to reveal anything.
No, reveal whatever you want.
Well, yeah. I mean, in terms of people who are listening to this. Right. But there is one key identifying revelation late in the book involving the dog perspective. And I'm wondering, what did you use any science for this in terms of dogs being able to recognize their past? I mean, how do you know the dog would have this kind of memory? I mean, the dog has a very good memory. I mean,
You know, I don't base any of my characters on real living beings, except my dog. The dog in the book is very much related to my dog, who I got when he was 1.5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I know nothing about his history except he was surrendered. And I also know that he has very particular quirks, and he obviously knows certain places and knows certain directions. And I was trying to figure out for a while, why is it? Why does he react to certain people in such a way? Why does he go this way and why does he not go that way? Why does he respond to certain voices in a way? Like, before he had known any children, as far as I knew, he had a very definite reaction to the sound of children's voices. Mm-hmm. And there were just certain individuals who would wear certain kind of jackets or looking a certain kind of way, and he would react to that. And I didn't do any research on dog science, but I tried to get into his mind and think, well, why is he reacting that way? And the other thing in terms of dog memory is, at least with my dog, he remembers people after only having met them once.
Hmm. Could just be the smell, though, you know.
Could be.
You actually have him remembering specific people as opposed to smell.
Right, but you can't write smell. How do you write smell unless you do like a John Waters smell-o-vision thing? You can't write smell. So, yeah, I mean, this is... I think this dog is much more literate than an actual dog. Yeah, my actual dog... Is he responding to smells more than, you know, his memory of this particular person at this particular time who said this particular thing? Probably not. But it was interesting for me to explore that.
I'm curious, in terms of the dog, and I am rather obsessed with this subject, but which came first, the perspective or this revelation later in the book that kind of...
The perspective. I mean, it was, with everything, it's a process of trying to figure out why characters behave the certain way they do. Like, why, for me, the story began with a man and his dog returning home, finding strangers in the apartment. And then it became, who were the strangers? And why was the man coming home? And why was the dog reacting the way they did? And from that, I built a story. For better or worse, I don't necessarily know what's going to happen when I'm writing. I just go along with it and see what seems to make sense, what seems to ring true. Sometimes there are plot points that I think are coming up, they don't. Sometimes there are endings that I think are going to happen, they don't. And it's just trying to be true to the character's experience as I go through it. But no, it's never the, you know, incident and try and build a character to fit it. It's the other way around.
But isn't there a certain risk, particularly when you have this more conceptual approach in the sense that each chapter begins with the broker or the buyer or the seller and all that? There are actually, for example, a number of coincidences that crop out throughout the book, as well as the fact that you have multiple types of characters. There are a lot of... In fact, there are at least 4 relationships in this book, without giving anything away, that involve an older man and a younger woman, as opposed to the other way around, as well as a number of people who actually earn their living through writing. And so is there a certain kind of risk in having repetitive patterns along these lines, or was there more of a specific angle that you had in mind in terms of...
Well, I mean, I try and... What you say about repetitive patterns is, I hope it's a pattern more than just mere repetition. I hope I'm, you know... more to the classical music side of things than Philip Glass. But I try and write, you know, there probably is a risk of repetition. But I see them less as repetitions, as variations on themes. Mm-hmm. And when I write, I try and... I was writing, in my mind, a book with music. I write to music. I have music in the background. And I was writing in terms of themes and variations, overture, coda. And some of those repetitions, hopefully, should be things coming out like they would come out in music. It's a pattern. You hear it in a different way. You hear it at a different time. It means something different. So it's perhaps, you know, thematically there might be repetition, but hopefully it has a musical element, a musical purpose to it.
But certainly at the fourth instance of older man, younger woman, you had to be sort of saying to yourself, well, maybe I should maybe kind of invert that formula so that it doesn't actually be like the fourth indication of this. I
mean, there's an older woman and a younger man, and there's a much older woman and a much younger man.
Oh, there is that one, too, yeah.
But
yeah.
That wasn't because I thought I was repeating myself. It just seemed natural for the story to these characters. But, I mean, I think it's dangerous to get into a situation where you say, I mean, if I feel I'm being true to the storyline and true to the characters, if there's some repetition in it, so be it. I wouldn't want to get into a situation where I'm saying, well, I have four characters who behave this way, I should only have three. Or I have three situations like this, maybe I should only have two. I don't really think about it that way. It's just how the story flows, how people interconnect, and I'll have to go back and figure out who all these four older men are involved with, four older women. I didn't realize that until this very moment, and I'll have to do some math on it. But, I'll have... It's not my personal experience, but it's...
I'm wondering if it tied into this whole nature, because there's very much a... I was actually going to mention that this book has a sort of dialectic going on between moving to New York for art versus being caught up in the kind of commercialism or the capitalism aspects of this particular city. And I'm wondering if it had something to do with that, this fixation. I mean, it seems to me that it was purely subconscious on your part, but maybe
I'm out of therapy. Maybe I better go back and find out what it means. But the fixation is related to... Tell me.
Well, I was thinking that it may have been related in some sense to this concurrent dialectic going on through the book between art and commerce.
Right.
And maybe you can describe how that came to being. I mean, it's definitely there from the get-go through this initial scene, in the sense that here's a guy who moved here to be a pure clarinet player and all that, and then here he is having his livelihood, his life totally usurped by this.
I mean, I think it's a lot of what's happening in New York. I would say for better or worse, but I think it's for worse. And it's a lot, I mean, it's my peer group. Most of us, with rare exception, came here to do art. We came here to write. We came here to act, to do theater, all sorts of things, to music. And a lot of people found to make a living they had to do something else because the city's becoming unaffordable. And so this theme repeats itself. We talk about recurring themes, is that it seems almost in many different environments in the book this theme repeats itself, whether it's in the world of magazine journalism, whether it's in the world of theater, whether it's in the world of writing novels. So there are these characters who come to New York thinking they're going to do one thing and wind up doing another. But it's not a new theme. I mean, Leonard Bernstein explored when he was writing Wonderful Town, all these people who come here to be editors, they wind up selling fish at the Fulton Market. It's not quite that. But because of the unaffordability of city as represented by the real estate scene, which I was experiencing and describing, a lot of the art is being drained out of the city, or at least being pushed to the borders and pushed to the outer boroughs.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the real estate scene, you have Joshua frequently suggest that to basically destroy the walls in all these various apartments that he's showing. Was this based off of a specific mantra that you observed during the course of your research?
Yes. Yeah, no, everybody. I mean, I went to real estate school and took a bunch of hours of real estate class and took my tests and spent a lot of time going with brokers. Yeah, there are two things going on there. One is that on a very material level, he's trying to tell people how to improve their building, because if you see a building that doesn't look like the one you want to buy, a broker's job is to basically try and get you to imagine what it would be like, you know, if it didn't look the way it looks. So the easiest way to say that is take down that wall, and then it becomes a different apartment in the person's mind. At the same time, I think what I was doing subconsciously as a writer was, because it's a very theatrical book, but at the same time trying to connect with the reader, I think what I was trying to do was take down the fourth wall, like you do in theater, but also take it down between, do it between reader and writer, or reader and character.
And yet you have also the very camp theatrical production, the gay musical thing that we all have to sort of suffer through for this, with just completely over the top sort of moments. Was this your, I guess, is this kind of related to this notion of breaking down the fourth wall in a theatrical manner to display this art versus commerce dialectic going on?
Well, I mean, I spent 7 or 8 years as a theater critic, and it was, you know, it's interesting to see what becomes popular and what doesn't, and the reasons it becomes popular. And, you know, New York was a great theater town at one point, and it still is on the off Broadway worlds. But in terms of what really connects and what, and, you know, it's, I know very few people now who go to theater who are among my peer group. Either we can't afford it, or it's, you know, we're, you know, treating our relatives who are in from out of town and want to see a show, which really, it's, I feel it's less and less part of New York culture and become more a part of the tourist scene. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
now, in terms of using the present tense in this book, how did that come about? Was it just a matter of really wanting to convey the present?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that was a very easy
No,
answer.
No, no, it is, because the first two books that I published, the first two novels, are very much in the past, looking back at the 70s and 80s, Chicago, and then branching out from there. Here, I wanted to write, I was writing in the moment, and this goes back to the topography of it. I wanted everything to be accurate to, you know, with exception. Everything within this neighborhood where we're sitting right now, this Manhattan Valley between 96th to 110th, I want it to be accurate. Everything else is pretty much fictional in the book. So I didn't want to like product place a bunch of restaurants and be like that kind of, you know, in the know, this is where everyone goes in Midtown Manhattan book.
Although the Ding Dong Lounge does make frequent appearances.
Everything in this neighborhood is right.
Yeah, yeah.
Or was right, but it kept changing as I wrote it because I was trying to write in the present tense, but things kept, you know, buildings kept going condo, or buildings kept getting, businesses kept being forced out. So try and preserve this one moment in time, writing in the present tense, it was somewhat difficult because all cities are changing, but New York seems to do it a lot faster than most.
Yeah.
So
there were no invented restaurants or bars throughout this, or?
The ones that aren't in Manhattan Valley are invented.
Yeah, okay.
But, I mean, most of with a couple, I needed to stick a real estate office someplace and a theater someplace. So those, but those are on the histories of those places, which I did a lot of research into, is true,
yeah.
Mostly.
Going back to this issue of commenting on the theater world, you have this character named Miles who is introduced essentially asking for his shower and using old English, like, where art thou tal, and things like that. Was this based on any specific sort of, I guess, pretentious actor you might have observed?
No, every character is an amalgam of, you know, imagination and 10 or 20 people I know, or it's someone I see walking down the street and I try and imagine their life, but, no, he's both pretentious and he's ironic about being pretentious.
Or he's a new world with the old world sort of ironic vernacular, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's how he talked when I heard him talk. Mm-hmm. So, no, I've known plenty of pretentious actors in my time, but you know, he's 20 of them, not just one.
The character of Daryl reminded me very much of Julius from The Emperor's Children, and it almost seems to me that
I haven't read. I was just discussing it with someone walking her dog this morning, by the way. And she was on her way to the train, but I haven't read it.
So. Well, it made me sort of wonder if you're writing about a New York novel, do you need to now have a character who has this sort of sense of entitlement these days? Is that really kind of something that's just almost permanently affixed to New York?
I'd have to go to it and see if all my characters have a sense of entitlement, sense that they feel they belong here.
Character with a sense of entitlement, like Daryl. Yeah.
Gosh.
There just seems to be more novels along those lines I'm seeing.
I could have written the novel without him, you know,
yeah.
And I think it would still exist. But that's an interesting question. I'm also not entirely certain I've written a New York novel. I think I may have written a Chicago novel that's set in New York. Because there's things that I'm obsessed with being coming from the neighborhood I do in Chicago and being, that being in my blood, that I think I may have transplanted a lot of my sensibilities to New York. I mean, again, I don't know what a New York novel is per se. But I know that almost every one of my characters, I'd say with one or two exceptions, nobody comes from New York. Mm-hmm. So I've written sort of an outsider's New York novel, I hope. I've immersed myself. I've been here seven, 8 years, and I've really immersed myself in the neighborhood and in the scene. But I still, almost everyone I talk to and interact with, whether they be writers, dog walkers, very few people I write about come from here. So whether it's a New York novel, I'm not really sure.
Well, how would you define a Chicago novel and a New York novel? Or is such a distinction even necessary
being flippant,
these days?
But Chicago, there's just this obsession with neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wrote about a specific neighborhood, and a lot of other writers in Chicago do it because we're very attached to our, you know, 1-2 square mile neighborhood. Here, neighborhood, everything happens fast, everything's condensed, a neighborhood's a block. And it changes from block to block. So I'm still writing about neighborhood, but the neighborhood maybe only two blocks long.
Yeah.
So,
and well, it's also very parochial here. Like, for example, this neighborhood, it's been known as Manhattan Valley, Morningside Heights, depending upon who you talk to, depending
on
the broker.
Oh, no, I mean, but people get pissed about it. You know, people, I talk to people, and, like, I actually had arguments when I was going with people to fact check. Just because, I mean, I actually, at this very cafe, I met with people from this or that development council trying to get their take. What's this neighborhood? What was it like?
Really?
And people were like, no, this isn't Manhattan Valley. This is the Upper West Side. No, this isn't the Upper West Side. This is part of Harlem. This is, so it's, and the funny thing about some of these conversations is these heated arguments were, I'm from Chicago, they're not from New York, but people get very attached to their neighborhood, and it's symbolic by what they choose to call it. So,
well, some people also don't call it anything and really resent this nature of having to stick to a particular appellation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that too. I mean, I don't really sit around saying I live in Manhattan Valley or I say I live on the Upper West Side. I say I live on Duguesclin Boulevard because it's a street address.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of the fantasy of, you know, real estate brokers on one side, community activists on the other side who need to identify it in a certain way for their particular purposes.
But in also pointing out that people outside of the city call 6th Avenue Avenue of the Americas, that's also sort of suggesting that, well, these brokers actually look upon the city very much like tourists do.
Right. Yeah, but there's a whole kind of like pecking order in New York based on who knows what was here and who knows what it was called then. It's like, for example, I had a number of New Yorkers read the story, and I refer to Stranger's Gate, which is the entrance to Central Park at 106th Street. And New Yorkers like, no, you didn't get the neighborhood, right, because you call it Stranger's Gate. I mean, there, a lot of people I know call it Stranger's Gate because it's been there, but those signs have only been up since 1989. So they were part of Olmsted's original plan to have those signs, but they never went up until the late 80s.
Yeah.
So people who were here before think it's kind of like an artificial construction. So if you call it Stranger's Gate, you don't know New York history before 1989. If you were here in the 70s, you wouldn't call it that.
Yeah.
So,
well, in terms of researching these particular distinctions, I mean, what kind of arguments did you have? Did you vacillate yourself in terms of identifying a particular landmark? And also, did you decide on any criteria as to what you decided to include in the book? Like, for example, there's the whole, you know, the love sculpture makes frequent appearances as well.
I couldn't leave the. I was just. I mean, as I said, method acting, method writing. I was just, you know, I would go to the places where I wanted to write about. And if there's the guy I happened to be writing about, was kind of in this point of his life where he didn't know if he wanted to stick with one relationship, go to one or the other, is happy with the decision he's made. I was standing in front of where I thought this mortgage approach should be, and I was leaning up against the Robert Indiana love sculpture.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to put that in art officially because it would seem almost like cheesy symbolism, but there it was, and right there at Commerce Bank there was a sign that said, "Do you need change?"
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, these things, you know, if I were filming a movie, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
You just,
yeah.
And I wanted just to, you know, that's where the character was. That was what the sign said. That was his view across 6th Avenue or Avenue of the Americas, as he calls it, because he's not from New York. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, if you try and write accurately to a neighborhood and to a character, I find these residences come up almost in ways that seem surprisingly almost over symbolic. But if there were ever I wouldn't have put him a block away and moved him back just to stick him next there, because that would have seemed phony to myself to do it, though no reader would necessarily know. But I, you know, it was important for me that, you know, I wasn't going to leave it out because it seemed, you know, impacted with symbolic weight as well.
But this is a very interesting idea to me, because here you are dealing with something in terms of trying to convey the real, and sometimes it may read as if it's more heightened than it actually
is,
but when in fact it actually is that heightened. Like, for example, like speaking, going back to The Emperor's Children, looking at that book now, and I first read it, I lived in San Francisco, and now that I'm actually in New York, I actually realize, well, actually, she wasn't all that crazy in terms of the over-the-top thing. Just as, I suppose, did you consider this when writing?
I mean, I read this interview once with Garcia Marquez, where he was being interviewed about magical realism, and he said anyone who thinks it's magical, like, or in reality, hasn't been to my hometown, come look at it and then telling me it's magical and it's... And it's, I mean, obviously, in terms, I'm writing a book, but I'm also writing something with a musical element to it. The coincidences have a certain, you know, heightened. It's lots of things happen that may be a little too convenient. Lots of characters may seem heightened, but I was trying to write true to the my experience, my character's experience, trying to view it through their eyes, and this is what came out of it.
Was it more difficult for you to write this book while inhabiting the neighborhood as opposed to the other books where you wrote that from afar? Or
any
advantages
so.
Or disadvantages? Or?
I mean, just my life's different in that, you know, when I wrote the first two books, I hadn't had a kid yet. So, I mean, time is different. I mean, I used to have all the time in the world.
Yeah.
Now I don't, and I have to be very focused about my writing and only do it within a certain amount of time, and there are lots of more distractions than there used to be. So, you know, real life impinges in a different way than it used to. But, you know, in terms of the writing of this, it was actually liberating to write in the present tense because, I mean, this may seem like a silly thing, but when I was writing Crossing California, it takes place in 1981, and because I have this obsession with, you know, making sure detail is correct, I wouldn't listen to any music that happened past 1981, so I had to, like, winnow down my record collection. But when I'm writing from 2007, 2008, you know, I don't need to do that. I can pick anything out of my collection and listen to whatever I want, and anything that's happening right now is fodder. It's not necessarily dated. Whereas, you know, with writing the earlier books, like, things would happen in my life, and I'd be like, wow, that's a great incident to include in something, but I couldn't really include it in that book because it was, you know, informed with 25 years of experience later. So, yeah I think it was fun to write in the present, really.
Ellington Boulevard is subtitled the novel in A Flat. Now, that's a very nice sort of topographical pun there, or rather a sort of property-related pun, but I wanted to know if A Flat beyond this meant something else. For example, you have Ike, who's composing the Rhapsody in A-flat, he hears also an A-flat from the east, and I was curious about that.
Yeah, actually, there are very few symphonies that are written in A-flat. I went into research, I listened to some of them, and they all have kind of a very idiosyncratic sound to them. I listened to the note A-flat as I was writing to try and figure out could a dog, like, make a whine at that pitch, and, you know, fair enough. But, yeah, some things are freighted with great symbolic meaning. That was just kind of a fun goof.
I thought it might have been a reference to Indigo Blue or something, which is in A-flat.
After this interview, I'm going to say that. But,
okay, fair enough. There you go.
But it was that there may be things that are of deep meaning and to be honest, a friend of mine suggested the subtitle.
Oh.
And I was like, no, I had originally written it as a novel in B-flat because he lived in 2B. And it was the name, and someone's like, you know, a novel in A-flat's much better. And I was like, yeah, you're right. So,
you alluded earlier to writing in your previous books being a stickler for detail, and particularly temporal detail, and going into the history of how something...
Yeah, what did I get wrong?
Well, no, I wasn't going to mention that, but
I'm sure I did.
If you were trying to resist that impulse in this book, you have, for example, the origin of Ike's clarinet. You also have, later in the book, the history of the building. So is this, I suppose, an inveterate impulse of yours, or...?
Well, it's fun. I mean, it's nice to have things come from someplace. I mean, I could make up a complete history of a building on Ellington Boulevard, and for a certain amount I did, but it also, if I'm writing about the neighborhood, it was important to me to figure out, you know, all right, what buildings used to be, who used to live here, and I went to the New York Public Library to do census data, and after that, and did, you know, LexisNexis searches and so forth, who used to live on this block, and it was probably more, a lot of it was more interesting than like what I could have come up with. I took that and built fiction from it, but it was important to know what used to be here. Ditto for the clarinet, which is, I could invent a history for the clarinet, and I did to a certain, but it also was important to me to know, okay, what was the history of clarinet? Who invented this sort of clarinet, and what was going on in 18th century France? And then, I mean, obviously when you're researching the history of the clarinet and various people like Buffet and Muller, you don't know a lot of that. There are not a lot of great biographies written about these people, so you have to invent a lot. But I wanted to have the basis in fact. And also interesting resonances come up, like, for example, the initials of the clarinet inventor turned out to be the same initials of my character, which are I am, which, and there's issues of identity caught up with that. But that was purely accidental, and I just used it and went with it because Ike Morphy, the clarinet player, was, his initials were I am before I had found out anything about clarinet history.
Gotcha.
So,
I was also curious about the American Standard. Was this based, you know, this invention?
Five or six of them. I mean, yeah. I've worked in the magazine world. I've had friends who worked in the magazine world.
Just as Nick Renfeld reminded me very much of Nick Denton.
No. I don't know. I actually know a couple of people who used to work for Gawker, but I think I was... Unfortunately, I'm a little slow out of the loop on things. I don't think I knew who Nick Denton was until a year and a half ago.
Very close.
All right. Nick is close.
Well, Nick Renfeld, Nick Denton's... Anyway.
Renfield also eats cockroaches and Dracula, and I wasn't thinking of that either.
Well, in terms of Chloe, what rules did you sort of set down? I mean, in terms of like...
Chloe, the publisher of the magazine?
Yes, exactly. Was there a specific media figure you had in mind for her?
No. It's...
Or are you just being very careful with your answers?
No, I'm not. I'm not at all. I don't want to do that Romana Clay thing where you're making fun of a particular... Because I think that makes it very tied to a particular moment and a little bit shallow. I didn't want... No, it's not... I don't know who, Tina Brown, she doesn't have a magazine now. I wasn't thinking of any particular individual. I was trying to create a character, and obviously I've worked in magazines, I've worked in journalism, and I'm sure particular incidents come from particular people, but no, it's other than my dog, I don't want to base anything on anybody real, because I used to do that. When I was in theater in Chicago, I would write thinly veiled autobiographies where, you know, everyone would turn out to be an asshole, in my view, including characters based on me, so I could feel objective about what I was writing. But then it became a thing where it didn't mean much outside of the people who were in the know about who things were based on. And then it only becomes my perspective on a particular individual. And I don't know what the publisher of this or that magazine is thinking, doing, what their private lives are. It has to be invented anyway. So I'd prefer to do something that's just... based on my experience of human behavior, but not tied to any particular individual.
Then I guess how much is sort of reworked or revised or rethought, and yet you also have to kind of maintain some sort of verisimilitude, right?
Yep.
So how much of this is kind of twisted so that you don't, I guess, have references to other people? I mean, or is it a matter of just complete concoction?
Wait. I missed the distinction.
I'm sort of wondering, I mean, if you're going to... have a representation of human behavior. On
right.
some level, it must reflect your personal experience.
Right.
So I guess my question is, how does this relate to this issue of trying not to sort of...
Oh, so if you're basing something on human behavior, how do you not base it on a particular individual?
Precisely, yeah.
I mean, I'm not taking biographical detail from certain, but, you know, hopefully you talk to people, you read enough, you meet enough people on the street, you've kind of formed these... I mean, it's you take 10 people and you make them into one, but it's a subconscious thing. It's not sitting around consciously trying not to write about this or that person. It's just taking a situation, taking an individual who has a certain position, is in a certain way at a certain time, trying to imagine how they got there. And a lot of what I write is people in a particular situation, how do they get there? Like, crossing California, there are three people meeting on a block. That's how my story began. It's these people met her. Who are they? How did they get there? Here, it's five people in an apartment. I could have based this on my experience of walking into my apartment and seeing a real estate broker and a couple, you know, buyers in my apartment getting bitched up by my dog. I could have based it on that, but even if I did, then it would just be, it would be my imagination anyway. But it's more taking the simple situation, three people meet at a block, five people are in an apartment, and then just trying to learn what their motivations are, and hopefully the human experience, the reading, the interactions you have, create characters out of that. And, you know, apparently, you know, you write a lot about men obsessed with older or younger women because you're fixated on that or something like that.
No, I'm not suggesting you're fixated. I'm just curious. I'm more curious as to the impulse, really. You know,
I don't know. I never learn write about why I write about certain things until much later. It turns out I'll look back at something and say, oh, I was writing about that for this or that reason. So, anyway.
Yeah. You also use Sontag as a verb in this, and I'm curious how that came about. And also,
I use her as a noun, don't I?
Oh, yes, a noun, I'm sorry, a Sontag of white through her hair, basically. That's that you use that. I'm wondering how that, and it's also a sort of lowercase s. So
I think that's a good word. I think it should be in the lexicon.
I was going to ask if was this your effort to kind of coin something, or had you?
It wasn't an effort. I think I used the word a skunk of white down the middle, and I was like, well, no, skunk is black and white. That didn't make sense. So I tried to picture something, and then I thought, oh, Susan Sontag, and then I thought it was a good word.
There are also these numerous lists of cultural references, particularly in relation to Daryl, and I'm wondering
almost exclusively in relation to Daryl.
And there's also the sort of strange conceit of him wearing a Kurt Cobain T-shirt in the present day. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about cultural reference and how this relates to some of your characters, or is this basically all about culture, basically?
It is, but I have a certain pop culture obsession, and it couldn't be filtered through every character. I always make these connections and hear these quotations, and I wanted to have a character who would do that and who would make these connections, so I put it all on him. So he's the one thinking about, you know, bad 70s television and lines from Conan the Barbarian and Michael Mann movies. It allowed me to filter this obsession through. But I think a lot of my friends are like this, in terms they have this encyclopedic knowledge of, really, myself included, things that are completely unimportant. A lot of us, you know, who went to grad school in this are very hyper-educated in completely inconsequential areas. So, you know, there he is right there, modern, you know, culturally aware, but with armed to the teeth with useless knowledge.
Yeah, well, how does this tie into what the jazzman who Ike consults, who essentially tells Ike, people come here to move to New York and they don't necessarily know who they are, and they may not want to know what they really are. And that's essentially the truism. Is that sort of the truism that sort of the entire book can be hung upon? Or?
I would hate to be able to hang it upon a single truism, but it's, you know, it interests me that one of the things that I find different about New York than other places is people do come here with the idea that they're going to be this certain person, and then they come here, and they often change, they're often transformed, and part of the reason why I did a musical is because it's the idea of creating character and creating your own character, which is a very theatrical concept, is that people often become something else, but it's not necessarily who they thought they were.
Yeah.
The city has a way, because of its intensity and because of a lot of the difficulties here, of kind of bringing out the best and worst, or the mediocrity in people. And a lot of people become something that they didn't necessarily intend to become, but that's what they come, that's what the city brings out in them. It reminds me, I was thinking as I was writing that, I mean, there are two things I was thinking about. One was, I'm going to butcher the description of this film, but there was a Tarkovsky movie called,
Solaris? Stalker?
No, I think it was, which is the one with the zone? No, is it maybe Stalk? I don't know. Anyway, but there was a concept of the zone where you would come into this one place and you would have your wishes realized. The problem was, as I remember the film, and I may be butchering it, this is what I remember 20 years later, is you would come to this zone and you would have your innermost wishes would be realized, but it wasn't always necessarily something positive. You would come to this zone and, you would think that you wanted, like, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, whatever, but you came through it and actually, you wound up, your parents were dead, and you wound up with a lot of money. Or it was something like that. But it like the city, the zone, kind of represented to me something where people's, who they were, came out, but it wasn't necessarily what they wanted. But the other thing, one of the original, I had a lot of working titles for this book. It was called Stranger's Gate for a little while, but that sounded like a noir, which it isn't.
Or too much like Gates of Heaven. Heaven's Gate, rather.
Heaven's Gate. Yeah. No, I never saw that. Days of Heaven was good, but it was, and another kind of was called They Got What They Wanted.
Which sounds like a Peckinpah title.
Yeah, kind of, it's not a good,
Or a Sam Fuller title, which is some sort of vengeful World War II movie.
There was some movie called They Knew What They Wanted, but I don't even remember what that was. But the idea of these people come and they have these wants and needs that are, they come to New York and they, well, the title's self-explanatory, but what they want is not necessarily what they thought they wanted. But again, that wasn't the right title.
Yeah. Well, speaking of also cultural references, I thought that it was really interesting that Joshua was interested in this one-man version of Candide, which entirely misses the point of what Candide is about, which is about some sort of misguided spirit interacting with everybody in the world. So was this a way of mirroring the sort of sense of entitlement, the sort of solipsism that we see with
Daryl? Yeah,
no,
I think so. And I think what I thought was interesting about him and Candide is that, yeah, I think for a while the reader might think he I actually trying trying to, he might, you might think he's Candide until he actually reveals himself later.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was. I played with a lot of things that he could be obsessed with doing, a lot of the one-man shows, and Candide seemed to be the one that fit and was the one I was reading at the time. And it was just so opposite to what he was, though on the surface so similar to what he might have thought himself as, that I thought it was an interesting double play in there.
Well, there's also interesting physical characteristics, like the Megan Yu character has a streak of red in her black hair. Are you sort of suggesting that people come to New York and are corrupted by this?
Oh, dear. Come on. Yeah. She has a stylish haircut. I mean, I think people... Do I think people come to New York and are corrupted by it? Sure. I think a lot of people come to New York and want to be corrupted by it. I think, you know, but... if that's symbolized by a haircut, I don't think so. But, if it works, great. But it wasn't...
Okay, well, then let's look at just actual behavioral action. There's a lot of avoidance in this book. You have Daryl avoiding his dissertation. You have Rebecca...
Avoiding parenthood.
Yeah, avoiding parenthood. You have Rebecca avoiding the voicemail, the red light on that. And so I'm wondering if, really, it seems to me, if all these characters could just make a decision that their lives wouldn't be miserable, or is this kind of what you observe most of Yorkers?
I say the same about myself, but I'm not miserable. Yeah. It's,
or less neurotic, so to speak.
Right, but what would you have, people are complex. They have complex motivation. And, you know, if you have a novel filled with incredibly decisive characters, I don't know, you wind up with a thriller, I guess. I mean, you wind up with, you know, cops and robbers.
No, but you could have a character either humiliated by actually making the decision to pick up the phone and talk to this person and have to contend with the feelings that come from that particular experience. But in the moment that she's actually talking with that particular person, well, it becomes a little bit, you know, interesting. She has to put on a particular front. She has to pretend. I don't know. I'm wondering why you made the decision to have these characters avoid... in situations like this.
You're making me sound so much more decisive than I am, and I'm writing about indecisive people. Why did I do what? I'm sorry.
I'm curious why you had these characters avoid as opposed to be proactive, because proactive would have maybe...
Well, they're pretty proactive. I mean, actually...
I mean,
a lot of what happens here is indecisive people ultimately making decisions. I mean, Daryl, you know, makes... Finally, at the beginning, he's been weighing back and forth. Well, he actually finally confronts his dissertation advisor. He finally actually gets out of his marriage, which is a ridiculously selfish thing to do, but, you know, he does it. And, you know, a lot of these people, I guess, have a lot of... Ike's been putting off dealing with his apartment for years and years. I mean, and then the situation, he has to make a move. He has to do something. So I guess almost... the novel happens at this moment of people finally making these decisions, and either because they finally decide they have to, or circumstances force them to. And one of the things that interests me about, I don't know if this is going to relate, but what the hell, is one of the things that interests me about, I would never want to be a real estate broker, but as a writer, there are a few jobs I can imagine that are better than it, because you see people at the moment of a decision. You see the before, you see what they're doing now, and you see the after. You see this is where they lived, this is where they want to move, can they move there, can they afford it? And this moment of real estate is almost like it's a decision moment. And there are a couple jobs like that. It's, you know, real estate broker would be good. Actually, I once wrote, when I was being an alternative journalist, I wrote a lot about movers, because movers are people who also see these moments. They see a breakup, they see a marriage, they see a death, and they see one place to the other, like leaving a home, finding another home, which is like a really classic thing.
That's exactly what Joshua says in terms of, calls it a Neil Simon play, every particular detail, people coming to the city with hopes and people leaving with...
Right, and we're better to see that than through real estate.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, probably someplace better, but that's where it occurred to me to find it.
Daryl and Jane, it's interesting that they have this one thing in common, and that is really terrible titles for their particular work. And I'm wondering how this came about. Did you just encounter people with just the worst titles in the world? I mean, I don't even want to read these particular papers.
Well, I mean, come on. You know? There are a lot of dissertations I don't want to read. I mean, actually, I like his title. A Strong Pulling Meredith Masturbatory Metaphor in the Victorian Imagination. I like that one. No, it's not good. Wait. They have bad titles. I guess what they also have in common is, you know, a lack of perspective and not really judging what they're good at. So maybe that's what they have. Maybe that's what's represented by the fact that they have shitty titles for their work. But yeah, Daryl's not writing what he should be writing. Megan's not writing what she should be writing. And yeah, they're both in a place where they're dissatisfied, sure. And yeah, maybe that's represented through the titles.
There's also a number of passages in which Daryl is comparing the cost of something to the number of pizza slices over a given year.
I do that.
Oh, okay.
Well, no, please.
I mean, I'm curious as to where this fixation came about.
It comes up because someone was trying to sell my apartment for that, in 1989 cost like $2 and then like cost $2 zillion, and you're like, what exactly is the attraction? And for Daryl, he can't really afford to live in New York unless someone's bankrolling him, and he doesn't really participate in the culture of the city. He's a graduate student. He doesn't get it. And there are moments when I sit and I don't get it. I mean, people are paying gobs and gobs of money for, and you know, what does that equal? Yeah. And you know, what does it all add up to? And why are you here and not in Madison, Wisconsin, where he comes from? And it costs a lot to live in a lot of cities, but at a certain point you kind of wonder I know the attraction for myself of being in New York, and I know it for lots of, but you know, if you're going to be doing what he's doing, why he has to pay $10 more for a cheeseburger than he would elsewhere, it doesn't really make sense. He's unhappy. And why can't he be unhappy where, you know, a cheeseburger's cheaper at least?
But it's also interesting to me that he has this obsession with finances while also having a relative lassitude in relation to his dissertation, which also has the exact same sort of calculating impulse going on, assemblage of facts and the like, although in his case he initially at least considers this more sort of a willful hackery in which he can dupe the various conferences in which he can actually attend. So I'm curious as to where how that disparity came about in creating this character.
What? Sorry.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
No,
I'm confused. The disparity between
having an absolute precise sense of calculating things along the lines of comparison of prices, along the lines of basically saying to his wife, hey, we got to move on this apartment,
right,
versus basically sitting back and essentially just getting lost in all this pop culture. And you know, it's also tied in a lot in terms of how he relates to his dissertation. So how did this kind of varying how he approaches a problem develop, this character development?
Well, I mean, he's someone who's focusing on the wrong things because he doesn't like what he's doing, you know. So I think I do that a ton. I spend a lot of time. I should be working on this particular book, but I mean, you know, I want to know what the score of the White Sox game was. And I think a lot of people who are intelligent or somewhat intelligent, but are in the complete wrong place, find themselves absolutely focusing on everything that'll keep away from the one thing that they're doing, or the one thing that they think they should be doing. But, I mean, this novel's filled with people who are in a place they thought was right, but it isn't right at all.
Yeah.
And for him, it comes out in obsession with absolutely everything unrelated to what he should be thinking about.
But there's also a lot of imposition of characters' ideologies upon others. Like, for example, there's this desperate moment in which Mark thinks he can actually get Caleb on his side, if he basically will throw him U2 and Springsteen, which is a real foolish kind of indicator. So, I mean, you know,
he doesn't have a clue. I mean, he doesn't need to have a clue. He's had a very, you know, talk about sense of entitlement. He's a very entitled character,
yeah.
And yeah, he's trying. I mean, the funny thing about him is he's at the moment where he's finally trying to be an adult and make these adult decisions, and he becomes a lot less appealing character than when he was just some asshole running over people.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, there's also the nature of Joshua and the older actor who he reveres, and how his attitude completely shifts in relation to him. I mean, is this a matter of, I guess, having these imposed values of New York, or is this a matter of coming to New York and changing and becoming?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of me, and I think one changes when one sees the reality of some situation. I mean, you have this. I mean, there are these people who we kind of revere, but then when we actually see what their life is like, we see them off stage without makeup. You say, oh, "I'm not. That was my dream, but I'm not sure if I want that."
Yeah.
And I mean, there's with Josh, he has this rather naive idea of, you know, of what the artist's life is, and this old actor guy who, it just shows him what. Actually, where he could wind up. I mean, this is actually someone who led a very charmed life and is still leading a charmed life. I worked for a while with the actor Eli Wallach.
Oh, yeah.
And I worked with him on his autobiography. And he told me once, he said, one of the most depressing gifts anybody ever gave me was a stack of antique playbills. And someone had given him a stack for his birthday of like 1940s playbills. And he started looking through them. He didn't know who the hell any of these people were. And, I mean, Eli, you know, people will know who he is, and he's very lucky that way. But a lot of people, you know, they come to New York thinking they're going to be this impressive individual who was in this or that show, but you actually go look through the yellow playbills, what kind of life do they lead? What kind of life do they wind up leaving? And that's what Josh has to come face to face with.
But that's not exclusive to New York, though.
People but it's heightened here. I mean, people don't come to... No, of course. I mean, hopefully it's not a New York novel, as I said. Hopefully it has some universal elements to it. But it certainly, in terms of people wanting to pursue art and make their career at it, I mean, you know, they're not... It would be hard to write that story in Dubuque. You know, it would be... You could
write. But there are also other centers like L.A. or Chicago or things like that. People go to L.A. the same reason.
Right. Yeah, no, true. But that's... I mean, that's... Yeah, but I mean, that's... Yeah, hopefully that speaks to the somewhat universality of the theme. So,
is this something you're sort of wrestling with because you have this topographical fixation and here you are sort of wanting this more universal feel? I mean, then how does the city factor in at all? Or is it just a matter of just depicting a neighborhood?
I think the more specific you are to experience, the more universal you are. I think if you get really capture like a really small moment in a really small place, that's when you make universal resonances. I think if you do something generic like City A, City B, I don't think you're going to get as much resonance because it's what makes the story come alive, hopefully, is the reality of the situation and the specificity of it. And from that, you create something that other people relate to. What I found very interesting with my first two books is the people who most responded to it the way I wanted them to weren't from Chicago. People who were from Chicago almost always were very obsessed with geographical detail, whether I got this or that wrong, whether there was, you know, that drugstore wasn't there, this part of the park wasn't there. But, you know, readers from Finland, they saw a very particular experience through which they saw the universal, mm-hmm. whereas the people in the particular just saw the particular.
Do you think too much emphasis is placed on location in literature these days, or?
No. I mean, why? I mean, is there? I mean, who's... I think we're losing a lot of regional voice, frankly, and I think that's a drag. I think in literature, if I can soapbox for a second, I think because we have all these writers' programs where people don't necessarily feel like they come out of a neighborhood or a particular place, they came out of a particular institution, I think we're losing a lot of particularity of voice. And
MFA workshops are the evil devil?
No. I mean, lots of people were great people come out of there. But I think what's important is personal voice, personal experience, and I think location comes out of that. Mm. And finding, as I said, finding the universal and the specific, as opposed to finding it in the generic. So, if there's like a locational obsession in literature, then I'm missing it. I don't know who you might be referring to.
Well, I mean, in terms of topographical association, I mean, are we placing too much significance on where things are sort of structured or how the geographical grid?
I hope it disappears after a while. I mean, I hope what you do is you set a person down in a neighborhood, you show where everything is, what's going on, and then I hope the story comes out. Yeah. I mean, I hope it doesn't just become a story about who's living on this block and what street is there and what's... I just hope it's like filming a movie. You put all the locations in, you put this here, you put there, and then you film it, and hopefully, I mean, people are fit into their location, but they're not... But we're focusing on the people. We're not focusing on the buildings or the fire escapes or any of that. So,
but also how people live is very much an indicator of who they are, as it is with Ike from the very get-go.
Sure.
You know,
But I hope it's about. I mean, even though there's something that's sort of from the perspective of the apartment, I hope it's about the person living in the apartment, not about the apartment first. I hope.
Gotcha. Well, Adam, thanks so much for talking. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thanks.
All right.